For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
And thank you to Messrs. Biggs and Bernstein and everyone for producing Flashpoints, and to KPFA in Berkeley for sharing that with us here at KBOO Portland, where the time is 10:59 a.m. Coming up at 11, the Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Those who have not yet become members of the KBOO Foundation can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in outdoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle and commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop.
Gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together.
Good morning. I'm Tori Bortman, welcoming you to the KBOO Bike Show this morning. I'm here today with my co-host, Jocelyn Gowdy. Good morning, Jocelyn.
Good morning, Tori. So glad to have you back in the studio.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Are you prepared for the big one? There's been a lot of talk in the media about the Cascade Subduction Zone earthquake that could potentially release an earthquake big enough to shake Portland for up to 4 minutes and release a tsunami that would wipe out tens of thousands of lives on the coast. If you're anything like me, getting ready for it has been a conversation I've had in our household a lot recently, yet we haven't quite gotten around to building that emergency kit. Hopefully today's guest will inspire us to stop thinking about preparing and get into action. Help us learn how our bikes could be the key to evacuating and helping or being helped by our neighbors if the big one does indeed hit. Joining us today on the show is Joe Partridge. As well as being an avid cyclist and very accomplished mountain bike racer, Joe is an expert in emergency planning and disaster preparation. He is currently the Disaster Recovery Business Continuity Manager at CARE Oregon and formerly was the Deputy for Planning and Preparedness for Multnomah County Emergency Management and Emergency Management Program Director for Oregon Health and Sciences University. Joe Partridge, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So just out of curiosity, because this is kind of the first place I like to start, what attracted you to emergency management work and wanting to start thinking about this stuff? Because most people like myself, I think, kind of avoid thinking about it.
It was a total fluke.
So
my background was actually in public administration and political science, and I worked for a medium-sized city in Michigan and as an intern. And when that internship finished, there was no job for me in the city, so I went to work in a small town, but kind of kept my relationship with the folks there. And one day the city manager called me and said, "Hey, the city's been put on this 120 cities list. We're going to start getting some money for anti-terrorism work."
Okay.
"And we'd like you to come back and do this job for us for a couple of months," because I had a military background as well as public administration. And at that time, the program was run through the Department of Defense. So I came back and did that. And when those 3 years were expiring was September of 2001.
Okay.
So after that, the position kind of changed, and I've been doing that work ever since.
Okay. So what kind of emergencies are you prepared for right now?
Am I personally prepared for?
Yeah, in your life.
Mostly I look out for the relationship disasters. Those are the ones I try to keep my eye on.
Those are actually some of the most important.
I totally agree. No, I think that for anyone, the first step in understanding what to be prepared for is to understand the place where you live. So most of the disasters that people face are natural disasters. So understanding what sort of exposure you have to those is of course the first step. Second to that is, where do you live and work in relation to highways, railroads, industrial facilities that might use hazardous materials? That's the second thing that I would typically want to think about. And then finally, I would want to be concerned about other kinds of things that could affect us. Are you a place that could be a victim of a shooting? Are you do you work in or near a place that could be the target of a terrorist attack? Those are sort of like the third tier things that I would be concerned about.
Sounds like a lot of things to be concerned about. How do you prioritize, and how do you take the first steps to preparing for those disasters that you're maybe most likely to encounter in your lifetime?
Right, because as I said, this is Tori here, I'm not prepared because I get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So how do you prioritize?
Yeah, I think using history as your guide is the best first step. So looking at what has affected your community and your neighborhood historically. Have there been floods? Have there been ice storms? Have there been earthquakes? That's the first thing to look at. And you can find that information pretty easily via the internet. If you want a more in-depth analysis, in Oregon, every county is required to have an emergency management office. And one of the things that they're required to do is have a natural hazard analysis. So they look in a pretty thorough way at what kinds of disasters have affected the community in the past. They can also, you know, be a good place to start in terms of what do they recommend, given your particular location and the nature of the response program that's in place, to start you on that path to preparedness.
So, being that we're living here in Portland, what are the disasters that we should probably be most prepared for? We talked about the earthquake a bit. Is that the big one that we're all getting ready for?
Yeah, I think the earthquake is kind of the Super Bowl of disasters, right? If you're ready for that one, then you're probably ready for any of the other things that you might encounter.
Well, I know you just mentioned ice storms, and it's something I don't think about, but when we have one here, we've had ice storms that have knocked us out or knocked out electricity for people in the winter. You know, obviously it's cold at that point for days on end.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And that certainly is one that you're much more likely to encounter in any given year than an earthquake. Mm-hmm. There are also parts of the community that are prone to flood. So that's another important thing to know about.
And a lot of wildfires this year as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely, mm-hmm. For sure. That's definitely, you know, not something that we're as concerned about in Multnomah County. Not that there isn't an exposure. Mm-hmm. There is. And historically, there's been some really interesting fires in the West Hills. But when I think about people, you know, particularly living in Portland, that wouldn't be the first thing that I'd be concerned about, but it's absolutely something that would be on the radar. And if you live in another part of the state, your local emergency management program will absolutely be able to tell you what are the evacuation plans, what is the risk, and how can you best get prepared.
Well, and it seems like it's a good idea, you know, right now the people in North and South Carolina who our thoughts are with just got dumped 24 plus inches of rain over a very short period of time. And that historically doesn't really happen there. And so there's also this new thing of like, well, maybe there isn't a history, but maybe we should just be prepared anyway, because we don't actually know the way the climate has changed or seems to be changing, what's going to come next.
Right. So from a professional emergency manager standpoint, something that we've been, the methodology we use is called all hazards preparedness. So we moved away from, you know, specifically preparing for very particular disasters, except for a couple of exceptions, but because we want to be prepared for all of them. And it turns out that many of the steps that you might take to be prepared for any disaster are going to help you no matter the disaster that you eventually face. And any level of preparedness is better than no preparedness. Anything that you do is going to help you. It may not be everything that you wish you had done, but it will absolutely be better than doing nothing.
Yeah, it's funny. Just researching for this show, I now have started looking at rooms and places that I'm in for like things to go under, like tables to go under in an earthquake, because I've done so much of this research has been based around Portland and the big one and what's been in the news. Yeah, it's a different way of thinking. And it's not out of fear. It's just like, oh, hey, I go there, or hey, I go there. It's just kind of changing a mindset out of a panic mindset and feeling so overwhelmed that I can't do anything to being like, oh, a simple thing would be noticing the environment that you're in to know where you'd go and what you'd do if you're there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when you're educating the general public, what's the very first step that they can take toward preparedness? What do you kind of welcome them into being prepared for disasters with?
Yeah, the first thing that I always ask people to do is think about their individual situation, mm-hmm. because what I might need to do to be prepared is very different from someone in a different place in their life. So just assessing where you are. Are you a single person? Do you have a family? Is there someone in your family with special needs? Do you have a medical condition that requires treatment with medications? These are all things that will dramatically change how you prepare. And of course, as I said before, understanding the real risks that you face. If you live in a place that's more prone to certain kinds of disaster, then you're probably going to want to prioritize that preparedness ahead of someone whose main risk is, well, you know, I'm pretty safe, except for that I'm worried about the earthquake. And the difference is time. So preparing for an earthquake is a big proposition for most people, and it can be expensive to acquire the kinds of things that you need or maybe even make changes to the building or the home that you live in. Mm-hmm. And those are best approached for most of us over a period of time. For someone else who has more immediate needs, they may want to put that at a slightly higher level of priority and move ahead more quickly.
Okay.
So what are some of the infrastructure problems we could face here if the Cascadia subduction zone quake happened? I've heard that bridges will be down, that the largest supply of oil to the region might be compromised because it sits low and on some land that is half land, half water. Which you can, I'm forgetting the correct word for that, but you know what that is.
Liquefaction.
Yeah, it's sitting, that our oil supply is actually sitting on liquefaction, which isn't really all that great. So because I feel like the infrastructure can lead to like longer term problems, and it's going to lead directly into what we're going to talk about with bikes as we move on in the show. So what kind of infrastructure problems should we be aware of if it was an earthquake?
Yeah, I think you've hit the main ones. Something that I like to say is that our understanding of how the infrastructure in and around Portland in particular will perform during an earthquake is evolving. So what we thought we knew 5 years ago or 10 years ago is not necessarily the same thing that we understand now. So whatever you hear today, it's not settled, right? So, but given that, there are definitely concerns about the bridges. Many of them were built prior to our real understanding of the risk from a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. You mentioned the fuel infrastructure. If you ride Highway 30 out of Portland, you'll see that there are many large installations along the river. Many of those were built at a time, likewise, where we didn't really understand the risk. And while there are definitely safety measures in place for those facilities, we witnessed in the earthquake in Chile a number of years ago similar infrastructure that really did suffer some pretty significant damage. And there have been experts at the state level who have visited those sites and have expressed concern. So clearly.
Yeah, so it sounds like Oregon's definitely working towards maybe getting that stuff up, just like myself. I'm working towards getting
those improvements.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that it's fair to say that there's an increasing concern at the state level, both at the Office of Emergency Management, which is a state agency, and within the individual state departments. You know, I feel like there's definitely a lot more work to be done. And I think there are many of us in the field who sometimes look with concern at the pace of change and frankly the amount of funding that's been supplied to state agencies to meet some of the threats and risks that have been identified. I believe it is getting better slowly, but I still, you know, I would hesitate to give a grade of A at this time.
Okay. Well, when we talked a little bit before the show, you had mentioned something about the bridges that I thought was interesting, which ones you thought might be standing and which ones might not be standing and when we could use them. Because I think people are like, well, the new bridge, it'll hold up and we'll be at least able to go over that. But you had some interesting thoughts on that.
I definitely think that the new bridge does anticipate being able to withstand the earthquake that we would anticipate now, right? So that's definitely a good thing.
So it would be there.
We believe it would be there.
But it right? doesn't mean it wouldn't be damaged.
Yeah, so there's a concern not just with if you look at the bridge in a post-earthquake setting and it's still there, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe to use. It certainly doesn't mean that it's safe for vehicle traffic, particularly automobile traffic. So there's a really comprehensive plan in place for assessing those structures after an earthquake and not just the structure itself, but the approaches and the abutments and the other things that make it safe to use. And I do think that it's reasonable to consider that if one or more of the bridges are down, access to the remaining bridges might, particularly in the early hours and days after an earthquake, could be restricted to public safety and disaster relief use. So you may have a certain challenge getting across the river if you work on one side and live on the other. That would definitely be something I'd want to consider in my personal planning.
Because it could be days or weeks before they let somebody on the bridge.
Yeah, the city of Portland's got some really innovative plans that they have looked at to get people back and forth, because it as soon as you start having this conversation, it becomes pretty clear that that's going to be an issue for a lot of folks. But I do think that it could be a challenge. And I think it's not unreasonable to say, yeah, it could be days, certainly, before there's an easy way to get back and forth across the river. On the other hand, maybe not. Maybe
right. Well, it depends on how big of an earthquake or disaster or, you know, if there's landslides or, you know, there's so many factors that come in and come into play that we can model and put in all these things. You know, it's why, as you said a few minutes ago, you know, what we knew 10 years ago, what we knew 5 years ago, it's always evolving. And we, even with that information, we can't predict exactly what's going to happen.
The timing is so interesting because how long have we known that an earthquake is a risk in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, I'm probably going to get these dates wrong. But I will say first, there's a great resource. There is a... The state has issued a pretty good report that looks at the history of what we've known about earthquakes, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I looked at this a little bit yesterday in relationship to the building where I work. So one of the employees there had asked, you know, how I see our building looks like it's made of brick. How is it going to perform during an earthquake?
Because brick, I don't know if a lot of our listeners know this and have educated themselves, but brick is one of the most vulnerable structure elements out there for an earthquake.
Yeah, unreinforced masonry buildings are a pretty big concern and a risk. So it turns out that our building was built in 1988, and it has a brick fascia, but it is not an unreinforced masonry building. So that led me to look at some of the building codes, and the building code in place in 1988 was a stronger building code that had only been put in place in the late 80s, so better than what had been in existence before. But there have been three or four revisions to the building code since then, most of which moved towards more demanding performance standards for particularly for large buildings. Mm-hmm. So that's absolutely you know, something that's a concern.
As it should be. I know that I've done a lot of research into this for the show, and it's amazing what Japan has done, like with their buildings and their structures, to really make sure that things, they have some very advanced technology to make sure that we're nowhere near, that our levels of what Oregon mandates, even though they're better, are nowhere near the levels. And it's because Japan's had enough earthquakes that, and California's even leaps, and they're not even as good as Japan, but they're leaps and bounds beyond Oregon, because Oregon didn't really consider for a long time that, and even now, like as you mentioned a few moments ago, it's expensive. This stuff is really expensive. And so even in my own home, I think that's one of the things I got overwhelmed with, is we luckily have a wooden structure home, but it's going to need to be attached to the foundation. And that's not in our budget right now. So it's really hard to budget these things in and know how quickly we can move when you've got bureaucracy and money together. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of brings us to our next guest. Mike Cobb is here with us, a well-known fixture of the bicycle community. He's the co-founder of Frame Builder Supply, a bike frame materials distributor concerned with removing barriers to bicycle innovation. He is also the co-founder of the Disaster Relief Trials, which is described on their website as a disaster drill in the form of cargo bike competition simulating a three-day supply run. Mike Cobb is here to share with us how your bicycle can play a huge role in saving you and your neighbors in case of a disaster. Welcome, Mike Cobb.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, where did the inspiration come from for the disaster relief trials?
In 2010, we watched and heard and talked about the Haiti earthquake, and I think most of us had bellyaches about the insufficient global community response, including me. And I felt motivated to innovate. I just felt like, hey, we put a man on the moon. What is going on? You know, why is a year later, why is there a cholera problem? Why is there a shelter problem? You know, and so I thought, you know, if you're going to be an effective advocate, you got to choose something that you're passionate about. Of course, I'm passionate about bicycles. My whole world, you know, I view the world through the lens of bicycles, and so it didn't take long to figure out that a decentralized distribution system that didn't rely on infrastructure whatsoever, i.e. cargo bike supply runs, might help, you know, might provide a percentage of relief that we did not see, but we all yearned to see in Haiti. So I sat on that and developed it for 2 years, brought it up to local bike advocates to see if it actually was a good idea. They all said it was a good idea, so I thought, I gotta do this.
Now people have heard about it, so I gotta get something together.
So in 2012, I combined forces with Ethan Jewett and Travis Whitwer, and we founded this thing, and it's basically just to have fun testing and proving the relevance of cargo bikes to citizen-led disaster recovery.
So what is that actually, or what does maybe this year's race look like? If our listeners out there want to join in or just are curious, what does that look like?
Yeah, well, first of all,
because you said a three-day cargo run, but it's not a three-day
race. This is a great correction. Day three.
Oh.
Supply run. A three-day cargo bike competition would be the enduro version, and we haven't gone there yet.
Okay.
I like that.
Yeah,
that's a good
I
one.
Know Joe likes that. Perhaps going to Bend and, you know, on a supply run.
Well, and we'll talk about we'll that talk a little later in the show.
But that's beyond the purview of DRT. DRT, or Disaster Relief Trials, is about a shelter-in-place scenario.
What does that mean?
That means non-evacuation scenario.
Okay, so helping people where they're at.
Exactly, because in terms of an earthquake, I think that's in most scenarios going to be the mode of survival, is to shelter in place and access the resources that a city has. However, access is a big problem. If transportation infrastructure, if fuel infrastructure, if communication infrastructure, if emergency responders are tapped out, if all these things are not in their usual supply, then we need to decentralize and help neighbors with, you know, this amazing device that requires none of this infrastructure and that makes us resilient, you know, in peacetime.
Yeah, and kind of, I think that it also empowers people to feel like they can do something, because that's any disaster kind of makes you feel a little bit helpless.
Yeah.
And empowering people to have that idea and thought that they can do something is important.
Yeah. Do you have a cargo bike? What do your neighbors need? You know, 72 hours of supplies have run out. They're, you know, you might have a diabetic neighbor that's not fully prepared, you know? This is empowering. I have a cargo bike. I know damn well I can haul 200 pounds and I can get over a 1 meter barrier. And I know damn well a Hummer, you know, has a tough time getting over a 1 meter barrier, you know? So
Lot more trouble if it doesn't have gasoline in
it. Yeah, and it doesn't do anything if it doesn't have gasoline or if the roads are clogged. Mm-hmm. So yeah, empowerment. Yeah, this is a way that we can, as citizens, affect change that is within reach. So yeah, empowerment.
So back to what does the race actually look like? Like, how is it set up and how does it work?
It's not a race. It's a spirited scavenger hunt.
Okay.
it's an open course. And each competitor self-navigates between predetermined checkpoints. So your question was, what does the race look like?
If I wanted to go do it, what do I expect?
The competition complies with the 11 essential elements of disaster relief trials. So if you call an event a disaster relief trials, it has to, the most strenuous category involves self-navigating through at least 30 miles, visiting at least 5 checkpoints that provide authentic supply depot scenarios.
So what would that look like?
For instance,
what's an authentic?
For instance, Oregon Food Bank.
Oh, okay.
For instance, Red Cross. For instance, the Willamette River it is full of water that only needs chlorine to make it drinkable. For instance, a fire department where there might be some recovery supplies. For instance, a node, a communication node. These things are set up by
Joe can probably speak to this.
Yeah, Bureau of Emergency Management.
Can you speak to that a little bit? What is that node, and how would that node work in theory?
Well, in theory, there's a set of pre-designated spots around the city where primarily, at least at first, information will be available. It's a place where people can go to find out what's happening.
Oh, okay. That makes sense, because we're not going to have radio, power, cell phones, landlines. Yeah.
Right. And so growing from those neighborhood-based locations, the response will kind of grow from there.
That seems like a super important stop on your route.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's in fact, in the future, I might propose that DRTs are hosted at the nodes, because that's sort of a mission control area where cargo bikers would get assignments, realistically.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And Joe can add to that.
No, I think that would make perfect sense. What would be interesting to know, and something I don't know off the top of my head, is the status of that particular program. Mm-hmm.
If those have been determined at this point?
I know that at one point they had been determined, mm-hmm. and I don't know how much has been done with that in the interim. And it's kind of unique. That's not a typical way that cities are organized themselves. It's something sort of unique to Portland. So I'd be very curious to see what the...
And why? So why did Portland decide to do that? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think if I were to make a guess, it's because the city is sort of like a very neighborhood-based place, right?
Okay.
And a number of city services are organized on a neighborhood basis.
So taking advantage of that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's a guess, but it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm.
So you were talking about the 11.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
two more primary characteristics of a DRT is the most rigorous competition category will involve accumulating 100 pounds of authentic recovery cargo. And then,
do they start with that 100 pounds, or they have to accumulate it over?
Yeah,
all
it's
the stops?
It's a supply run, you know. So you know, it's analogous to like, oh, we got a party in an hour, we need to go get ice from this place, we need to get alcohol from this place, you know, and by the time you get back, you're laden with the supplies,
right?
And then those supplies will be checked in, palletized, in a tidy fashion before you get a finishing time. Okay, the other really important aspect to DRT competition.
And that's the disaster relief trials, just
Thank
for
you.
Our listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Disaster relief trials involves a really intense collaboration with the local amateur radio operators.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Communications.
Yeah. Multnomah County Aries is the organization that we work with. And boy, do they love testing their equipment and their skills with the disaster relief trials.
How does that partnership work? How do you use them and how do they use you?
Competition monitoring using radio frequency, which is...
So they're at the checkpoints?
They're at the checkpoints. Okay. Yeah. So radio frequency communication is invulnerable to most disaster scenarios. And so to know what's happening on a particular cargo rider's supply run, to be able to give him or she, whatever pronoun you want to use, instructions after they've left mission control. These are things that are...
Right, like all of a sudden we realize you also need to pick up this while you're there. And when you get there, there's a message that says, oh, you're going to add this to your supply run.
Yeah.
You know, I can see why that when Joe got into emergency management, why his military training came into play, because it seems like you need that kind of...
high-level organization.
Yeah, mm-hmm. those skills of being able to distribute, know what your resources are, know what's out there, and I can see how that radio is huge.
Disaster recovery, of course, is an extremely dynamic experience, and to be able to be up to date, despite the fact that you're on a bicycle, despite the fact that cell phones don't work, is incredibly valuable. And this year, Aries is going to be testing new technologies, including email over radio frequency and video over radio frequency.
Now, that could be in handy for medical emergencies and that sort of, for I'm sure a lot of different.
Yeah. If perhaps you're a radio operator, but you're not a medical expert, mm-hmm. you can send a picture of a situation
right.
to a medical expert and get an evaluation.
You are listening to the KABU Bike Show here on 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. We're on the web at www.kboo.fm. Please stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our conversation about how to prepare if disaster strikes in your town. We'll continue speaking with Joe Partridge, avid cyclist and disaster recovery business continuity manager at CARE Oregon, and Mike Cobb, co-founder of the Disaster Relief Trials, an annual bike race and events simulating how bicycles might play a key role if the big one hits. Don't touch that dial.
Cycling.
listening to the KBOO Bike Show. Today, we're focusing on how your bicycle might be a lifeline in case of a disaster. We're continuing our conversation with Joe Partridge, avid cyclist and disaster recovery business continuity manager at Care Oregon, and Mike Cobb, co-founder of the Disaster Relief Trials, an annual bike race slash event simulating how bicycles might play a key role if a disaster hits. So, Mike, before we took our little break, you were talking about how some of the rules of the event and what pieces put it together. Can you talk about the actual physical obstacles and those kind of rules that you have built in? Because I think those are super interesting.
Yeah, we try to test competitors in easy to imagine disaster challenges, including the infamous 1 meter barrier.
So 1 meter, that's 3 feet-ish?
That is 3 feet-ish. we force them to cross at least one meter barrier after they've accumulated some relief cargo. And so the idea is that if your bike weighs, 125 pounds, it's going to be a lot faster to unload and double portage and then reload. And it's fun to watch people hustle through that.
Double portage meaning carry all your stuff over, then carry your bike over. For those who aren't used to boat analogies.
Yeah, you've got a double, you've got the ability to sort of divide the load and break it up into reasonable chunks.
Are people allowed to do it in teams, like somebody with a cargo bike and somebody like a helper?
Great question. For the first year, we have a team category that I'm really excited about.
So you haven't previously?
Yeah, no, not in San Francisco that happened, but not in Portland.
Okay.
We've had a family category in Portland, which involves teamwork. We've had people...
And family, does that mean having your children with you?
Yeah, it means having a passenger, and small passengers are lighter.
Yeah, if you want to do well.
Yeah, if you want to do well.
At the disaster relief trials, the smaller the child, the better.
Better bring a small family member. But let's see, what was I?
We were talking about portaging and the different...
The team. The team, mm-hmm. Thank you. So the idea behind the team category is that, hello, buddy system, everybody, historically we've had some people enter the individual categories but act as a team because they're like, come on, we're going to work together, including, I think it was 2013, Joe Bike had, I think, 5 uniformed riders displaying utter grace over the barriers, bikes are just flying over. This year, it's going to be an official challenge opportunity, and it involves a three-person team carrying 2 payloads, not 3 payloads. And okay. So how are you going to do that? Are you going to have 2 cargo bike riders and 1 person on a cyclocross bike that can race ahead, that can navigate, that can scout, that can load, that can unload? That can portage, and then you'll have a couple of mules, and all they do is put their head down and follow the leader and haul their stuff. Or do you have 3 people that 3 cargo riders that divide the load equally? So your average speed might be fastest. These are things that I want to see creative solutions to, and so we're forcing people to come up with innovation.
And also, you talked about the 3-foot. I know another obstacle is a water obstacle. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that and why you put that in there?
Because flooding is a disaster modality that we need to cover, and we need to think about bikes don't work too well in floods, my original inspiration was to force a bridge-free river crossing.
Which would be awesome.
Can we get a pack raft company to sponsor the event,
Which, for those of you who don't know what pack rafts are, there are now companies who create rafts that are actually small enough and portable enough to be put either in a backpack or preferably a bike, and so that you can combo going biking and rafting in a river.
Yeah. So this might be a nice future challenge, or at least a nice expo thing to do. But in the meantime, we just flood a street, make it at least 15 centimeters deep. It's a great photo op. It doesn't simulate South Carolina conditions, but it's something to get you thinking about. Well, how do bikes deal with water?
Right.
You go hub deep. What happens?
So, also in an emergency, a real emergency or disaster, let's say power's cut out to Portland, we're not going to have stoplights and things.
Yeah.
But in during the disaster relief trials, we don't have a disaster actually in that moment.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that with the riders and stoplights and?
Mm-hmm. Well, a primary tenet of being a successful responder to an emergency is to keep yourself safe first. Arrive alive if you want to render relief.
Yes.
Right? And so, we think that it's appropriate to be extremely stringent about traffic law obedience in our competitions, because traffic laws are all about right of way. In the event of a no electricity post disaster scenario, there might not be lights, so there might not be sort of a mandate to stop, but right of way exists regardless of electricity, and right of way saves lives. Observing right away saves lives. So that's the advocacy is to, if you're shaving a couple minutes off of your delivery time by risking your life, that's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way we roll.
Right. And that's not even in the spirit of the event at all.
Yeah.
To break traffic laws, to try to get ahead.
There's no need to prove the point that cargo bikes are relevant to disaster response. There's no need to break traffic laws.
You were talking about innovation earlier and how, like, hoping people come up with creative solutions. So I was wondering, in the previous year's DRT events, what has been the most creative, innovative solution that you've seen to a problem?
One of the 11 essential elements that we didn't get to is there must be fragile cargo, represented by three inadequately protected eggs.
Okay.
So it's always fun to see what people bring to assure that they don't get a time penalty by breaking the eggs, i.e. breaking the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a briefcase, a waterproof briefcase with a customized foam on the inside. Like, great, that does it. You're worrying about other things now. You don't worry about that.
Sure, yep.
So that's been cool. It's fun to see the humble lash strap optimized for quick lashing and secure lashing and quick portages. I think competitors find that elastic load lashing devices are not useful. They're just not.
So no reusing the bike tubes as a lashing.
Hey, it is so much better than nothing.
Right. Well, but if optimally, you're saying that there's better options.
But if you want to optimize, if you want to compete well, I don't recommend it.
So what would you recommend?
I would recommend a cam buckle webbing straps. Cam buckle adjustable lash straps.
So that kind of leads to another question that I had, or two questions actually. One, if I want to compete, do I have to have a cargo bike?
You do. Unless
I'm on the team where I'm the scout, I would have to have a cargo bike.
That's a really good point. That is the one exception. But no, we are, the thing is in Portland and in many cities, we have this great resource called people who ride cargo bikes already, regardless of future disaster considerations, And so that's what we're tapping into. And in the future, I intend to create DRT trainers. So it's not a DRT event. It's a training for the DRT event where you don't have to show up with a cargo bike to learn about how to do these things.
That leads to my next question, which is, what would you recommend? Joe talked a little bit about thinking about preparing for a disaster in your home. What kit do you need to prepare for a disaster for your bike?
Well, I know Joe has a lot of thoughts on this. I'll start that you it's important to be mechanically self-sufficient. What are the most common ways for a bicycle to break down and render that tool ineffective? Learn them, know how to address them. It's called flat tire. You know, that's the main thing. Are you comfortable, you know, not just in theory, but have you practiced changing a flat? You know, remove that from the challenges of your supply run.
And the excellent thing about that point is the bicycle is a relatively simple machine. So it doesn't take too much to learn those, as opposed to learning how to work on a car in the event that it breaks. The bicycle is pretty easily learned and maintained.
Exactly. And that just feeds into the resilience mm-hmm. character of the bicycle. An automobile there's so many things to go wrong. There's a diverse array of things to go wrong.
And they're just computers these days. So
yes.
That's not resilient. So mechanical self-sufficiency, fat tires that are flat resistant. Mm-hmm. I like Slime. Slime is a product, is a brand name of a product that helps tubes self-heal.
Mm-hmm.
So virtually eliminate the need to fix flats in a post-disaster scenario where there's debris everywhere. Mm-hmm. That would be important.
Joe Partridge, do you have anything to add to that? Like, what does your emergency bike kit look like? Do you have one?
That's a good question. I think that when I think about using my bike in a disaster scenario, I think that I, you know, as a mountain biker and an avid tourer, I bring tools with me almost every time I go for a ride. And, you know, I've been riding bikes for a very long time, so I know what to do with those tools, right? But the only thing I think I might add to what Mike said is, you know, you've got stuff to take care of the flat tire. Perfect. Probably a set of Allen keys, because you're almost certainly going to need those for something. Chain tool.
I was thinking, like, maybe I need to make sure I have those extra couple spare tubes around the house. Yeah, maybe I never use Slime tubes, but maybe having a pair that's my mountain bike size so that I can install them if a disaster happens. And then the other thing I was thinking about is our bikes are mostly stored in our basement. How likely am I going to have access to my basement or be able to get the bike up and down the stairs? Maybe I need to make sure that the bikes that are the one which isn't a great bike, but that's in my garage, maybe I get the Slime tubes for that one, since that one's actually the one I'm probably most likely to be able to access. You had something to add to that, Mike?
No, I just think that's a great point. Like a bicycle that's squished under debris is no use.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a really important thing to think about, and a tricky thing to engineer in your, you know, tiny home or whatever. Well, not in your tiny home, but in many scenarios, apartment scenarios, yeah. Where's a safe place to store the bike? It's a good question.
Yeah, and I assume, as I've been thinking about emergency preparedness, that it would be a similar place to where I'm going to be storing my water and my food. But honestly, I haven't gotten far enough to figure out where that safest place is, because there's got to be one. I just am not quite sure where it is yet, so...
Well, you mentioned a disaster relief trial in San Francisco, so it sounds like there might be a few other cities that are doing something like that.
Yeah. It's not a franchise. It's a movement.
Mm-hmm.
And in Portland, we're developing a kit, mm-hmm. A plug and play kit, and we have to some degree already, so that cities who have advocates who are interested can not reinvent. They don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's happened in Eugene and Seattle and mm-hmm. San Francisco and Boulder, all called DRTs. And so they have the 11 essential elements that have been carefully designed to represent disaster modes. And then places like Victoria, BC, and a couple other municipalities have had bicycle-oriented disaster relief drills that aren't called DRTs. So I think this has all been spurred by the DRT movement. And I totally applaud people doing it differently. Victoria has a wonderful event that's been done twice now called the Tour Disaster. And it's really complex. It's like they considered you can score points for creative solutions to a number of scenarios that human power can address. Like, do you have a shovel? Do you have a pick? Mm-hmm. Like, what kit did you bring? Oh, we'll give you 5 points for that. Can you transport a person? So it's sort of this potpourri of displayed bicycle responses.
Yeah, and I like that thought of rewarding creative resourcing and people thinking ahead to what, depending on where you are, what your disaster in Colorado. I mean, whoever thought Colorado would have the flooding that it had a few years ago, and what is that need versus what we might have here, or South Carolina, or Chicago, or Minneapolis, or New York in a hurricanes. It's all a little different. You talked a little bit about the ham radio and partnering with that. Mm-hmm. Are there other agencies that you partner with and that you encourage if someone's setting up a disaster relief trial in their city? Who do you partner with here, and who do you encourage people to look to partner with?
Mm-hmm. City, county, state, federal, disaster or emergency preparedness agencies, all of them. And we've had success partnering with city, county, and federal level. And just now, there's nothing to report, but I would like to start a rumor about talks at the state level. Really exciting stuff going on. Governor Brown read the New Yorker article.
Oh, very good.
And she is motivated.
Paid some attention to it, yep.
And there's a transportation committee who is right now concerned with transportation resiliency visioning. Mm-hmm. And we're feeding this committee what we know about how cargo bikes can enhance transportation resiliency. So yeah, I definitely recommend getting in touch with city and county because they often have resources they want to show off at your event anyway. And that's happened in Portland. It's just been a beautiful partnership at the city and county level. And then FEMA is messaging like crazy that foreseeable future mega disasters, climate cause and otherwise, are no match for government budgets, are no match for government responder resources. They know darn well that citizen-led responses are vital, and currently we're insufficiently prepared to provide them. And so we...
Yeah, it's amazing that your number one resource is, let's look at GoFundMe, let's look at this, that. Crowdsourcing is just huge in any, whether it's you're trying to help somebody with a medical situation or whatever. We have a huge resource that is free, and it's us.
Yeah.
You know,
that's tapping into our own communities.
Yeah.
That's right. And resilience, it's so lovely how popular resilience, the concept of resilience is today. And it is so sellable because to be environmentally sustainable is to be resilient, is to be disaster prepared. It's this multiple win situation that has political will, especially since the New Yorker article. Mm-hmm. So exciting times.
Well, and speaking of statewide, there's been some talk that if we had a large enough disaster, probably like the earthquake, that would severely damage Portland, that in the long term, I know the disaster relief trials are mostly based on the short term, but in the long term, the next staging area for displaced people would be Redmond, Oregon, because it's the largest airport that wouldn't have been affected or minorly be affected. I know that the mayor of Redmond and government around there is preparing for that. This could be for you, Joe Partridge or Mike Cobb. How do you guys see bikes playing a part in that part of the evacuation? Do you think that there is a long distance version with bikes, getting people to Redmond, getting supplies?
Yeah, this is Joe. I think that certain individuals will make the choice to self-evacuate. And I think that being Portland, a certain percentage of those folks will use a bicycle, totally. And that was my plan, right? And my wife and I are both, experienced cycle tourists and have equipment and training. And for us to go for a 2-week bike ride is something that we would, not be intimidated by. That was before I had a 21-month-old daughter, right? And so now the situation is different. There are things that young, healthy adults can do that a family of 3 or 4 or 5 just are going to have a much harder time. The risks are higher. The margin for error is lower. So when I think about using bikes to evacuate, I think that it absolutely would happen, and it will only be an option for some folks. And then were I a planner at the state level or somewhere between Portland and Redmond or Bend or Boise, Idaho, I would want to be paying attention to that, because were evacuation by bicycle to be supported in some kind of official way with staging areas or support or guidance or route marking, it becomes much more accessible. If you've got to carry everything with you, particularly if it's winter, that's going to be tough to do. So that's kind of the long-winded way of saying, yeah, I think people are going to do it. It's an option for some folks. Lacking official support, there's only a limited number of people, I think, that could do that safely.
Right. Yeah. And I think that comes back to maybe being here and crowdsourcing and using the resources that we have here before we're able to get out. I know that we are getting towards the end of our hour here. I also want to talk a little bit about what resources are out there for people. We'll have some on our Facebook page, but if someone wants to get involved with the disaster relief trials, I also want to talk a little bit about the Great Oregon Shakedown, which is October 15th. That's being an event that's from the state of Oregon, and they have a great website out there. And what it is a trial run for you to be prepared for an earthquake. So there's a moment where they're going to say, "There's the earthquake's happening now. What do you do? Where do you go?" And just get you thinking more about your resources that are out there. But Mike, if somebody wants to be involved with the disaster relief trials, whether they're volunteering or want to
participate,
yeah, mm-hmm. test their mettle. Mm-hmm.
DisasterReliefTrials.com. Excellent. That's a clearinghouse for all things disaster relief trials, including the registration link for this year's competition, which includes a volunteer registration category.
And what's the date of the...
It's October 17th, which would represent day 3 after the Great Oregon Shakeout.
So there you go. You can mimic along. And there actually have been, Oregon Public Broadcasting did a couple stories, and one thing they did was have people test run actually a 3-day scenario of being, having to actually rely on their 3-day supply. And I think it was an eye opener for a lot of people to say they thought they were prepared, and then how often, they reached for the kitchen sink and couldn't use it because they didn't have water or et cetera. So that's good. It's a great mock-up situation. And Joe Partridge, do you recommend people find the best resources to prepare for any disaster?
I mean, I think starting with Multnomah County Emergency Management in Portland, Bureau of Emergency Management is a great place to start. State of Oregon website has some good information as well. And there is pretty good information at the federal level. FEMA has just a ton of people dedicated to outreach, and they produce good information on this topic.
Awesome.
Great. Well, when you go to learn, share it with your neighbors. Don't keep that information to yourself. Pull your community together. Have that conversation. Know how you're going to help each other. Don't wait for somebody else to plan it for you, right? It's fun to have these resources, but take care of yourselves out there.
You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show here on KBOO in Portland. We're here on the air the first Wednesday of every month. Thank you very much to our guests Mike Cobb and Joe Partridge for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
To find out more information about the bicycle relief trails and how you might prepare for a disaster, links will be up on our Facebook page later today. Our show is podcast and archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. You can also find our most recent episodes free on iTunes. Thanks to our brilliant podcast engineer, Josh Hetrick, to Portland Transport and Chris Smith for hosting our podcast. The Bike Show is hosted and organized by myself, Alon Robb, and Jocelyn Gowdy. Thanks to our magical in-studio engineer, Sam, without whom we would be fumbling through the airspace. Have a great day out there, and as always, keep riding your bike.
How could I forget to mention the bicycle is a good invention? Sitting there in a silent movie beside the only girl who really ever knew me. Happy days but sad facing. Heaven knows I'm all...
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Zakir Hussain, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. Zakir Hussain is most well known as a tabla player, and he will be exploring the impact jazz has had on Western and Indian music with special guests, including Shankar Madhadevan and Dave Holland. Again, that's Zakir Hussain, Wednesday, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, 1037 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program was made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Deacom Street Doorway, a Linton feed and seed store offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30 at Northeast Deacom and 8th. Entrance on 8th. DeacomStreetDoorway.com. And Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th Annual Teaching with Purpose Conference on October 9th and 10th at Park Rose Middle School, located at 11800 Northeast Shaver Street, Portland, Oregon. The Teaching with Purpose Conference provides information, tools, and materials relating to culturally responsive teaching. The conference aims to address legislation relating to culturally responsive education in Oregon and around the country. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.